My name is Janice Bellucci. I welcome you to the monthly Zoom meeting of the Alliance for Constitutional Sex Offense Laws. We do this, in fact, every single month, and I will be joined later today by Axel board member Eleanor Miller, and she's not here yet, I don't think, but she'll be here soon. Ellie, by the way, is a criminal defense attorney, and I'm a civil attorney. And so, believe it or not, I think like a lot of doctors, attorneys also specialize, and so I really don't understand criminal defense laws. I wait up. It's too late for me to learn, I think. I've now been practicing law for 41 years as of this. I can't believe it. It's been that long. But it has. And so I'm happy to bring my experience and my knowledge to the issue here of people on the registry as well as members of their family. So having said that, let's go ahead and get started. Folks, every single month we talk about two issues in particular, and we'll be talking about a variety of issues today. But let me start out with two issues. One has to do with compliance checks, and the other one has to do with scams. So the what I'm going to say now about compliance checks is true nationwide. Okay, and in fact, I want to remind folks that Axol is a nationwide organization, and I'll talk about some legislation that we have pending now in other states. We started here in California. We filed over 100 lawsuits in California. California and change the daily life. I think the lives of people on the registry in California, and now we're extending our litigation to other states as well. So let's go back to compliance checks. When the police come and knock on your door, and sometimes they do it in full gear, and I'm including they might look like they're a SWAT team, right? Which is way more than is required. But basically, the purpose of a compliance check is, in fact, to confirm that you live at that address. Now, why would they be doing that? Well, there's a real reason, and then there's a supposed reason. So let's go to the real reason first. The real reason they do this, quite frankly, is because they get a government grant to do it. Okay, so the state governments often give grants to local governments. The federal government sometimes does the same. And so, they're only too happy, the people who participate in these compliance checks, to basically get paid overtime, right? To pay overtime to go ahead and to knock on your door and possibly to harass you. So I'm going to, so the information I'm going to give you here is to help you understand what you need to do and don't need to do if in fact they knock on your door. So if the police show up at your door and you are not on parole and you're not on probation and you're not on supervised release, guess what? You do not have to answer the door. You don't, okay? You can crank up your music. You can go soak in the tub. You can bake some cookies, whatever it is. Work in your garage, whatever it is that floats your boat. You don't have to answer the door, even if it's a compliance check. If they really want to know if you live there, guess what? They're going to leave a note and say, "We were here, and please contact us." And again, the only purpose of the compliance check is, in fact, to ensure that you currently live at the address that you say you do. And the purported reason for this, by the way, is that number one, they believe that everybody on the registry poses a current danger, and number two, that if only they know where you're living, well, then they can help prevent, a reoccurrence. Nonsense, nonsense, nonsense. So don't worry about it. By the way, if you are on parole, if you're on probation, or you're on supervised release, you probably have a condition that says they're allowed to search you and your residence at any time. Okay, if indeed that's you're on parole or probation and you have a condition like that, if they show up the front door, you have to answer the door. And guess what? You also have to let them in your house. Again, only if you're on parole, probation, or supervised release. So let's talk about for those who are not on parole, probation, or supervised release, you might choose to answer the door. Now, why might you choose to do that? Maybe you live in a condo, maybe you live in an apartment, and all your neighbors are seeing, all these police officers show up your front door. So you might think wisely that in order to get rid of them, you need to go answer the door. Okay, but this is my strong recommendation. If you answer the door, you don't have to keep the door open. My recommendation is you step outside the front door and close that door behind you. And why would I say this? MEMI, if you'd be so kind as to change something, there's some big glaring thing that's behind you. Maybe you can a light or something. So you don't have to let them in. And then the other thing is you don't want them to, thank you so much. You don't want anybody to look into your house because if the police see something that they consider suspicious, and it could be, the most benign of things, by the way, then what they can do is they can say, oh, that's probable cause to search a residence. So we don't want to give them that opportunity. All right. So again, what I'm recommending, if you're not on parole, you're not on probation, you're not on supervised release, and you choose to answer the door, close the door behind you, because I bet you'll figure out a way to get back into your house. But again, you don't want the police to be looking at, what is in your house. This is an example. I had a client. He wasn't a client at the time, because otherwise I would have advised him to do something quite different. But the police showed up at his house. He wasn't on parole, probation, or supervised release, and they said, oh, well, you don't mind that if we can, do you? And he said no. So he gave consent by saying no, he didn't mind. Okay, so they came into his house, and then when they're in the house, they're looking around, they go, oh, I see you have a desktop computer over there. Do you mind if we look at your computer? And he said no again. Folks, that's consent, right? So the next thing he knew, law enforcement was looking at his computer, looking at what was on his computer, and they spent 45 minutes looking at his computer. When he told me that, I was so shocked and horrified. The good news is they didn't plant anything on his computer because, quite frankly, that would be what I would be worried about most of all, is they would add something to his computer that wasn't on there before. So as it turned out, there was not a negative result of that. But the fact is, he allowed the law enforcement to come into his house. That was the first mistake, and the second mistake was allowing them to look on his computer. So please don't do that. Okay. Ellie Miller, welcome, man. Welcome.
Good morning.
I've already sung your praises, but again, Ellie is joining us. She's a criminal defense attorney. She's also currently a professor at Loyola Law School in Los Angeles. So, Ellie, when you have a criminal defense question,
Yeah.
I'm going to ask Ellie to answer it for you. It's
All
like,
right, I'll
all right.
try.
All right. So somebody is in the chat room is saying a compliance check was done on me. I was not at home. The police department then knocked on the neighbor's door to ask questions about me. Do they know where I work? Do I live at my address? And do I hang out in the front yard? I am on supervised release. Unfortunately, it's legal for them to do that, the law enforcement to do that. So because you're on supervised release, maybe if you weren't on supervised release, maybe it wouldn't be. But the fact is, it is legal. Okay. So the other thing we talk about every month, and these are really important and basic issues. That's why we keep repeating them. Folks, there are scams out there. There's scams and scammers out there. And my understanding is somebody, you'll get a phone call, or maybe your spouse will get a phone call saying, oh my gosh, you or your spouse failed to do something, right? And there's a warrant out for your arrest. And these days, quite frankly, a lot of times it has to do with DNA, your DNA sample. Either it's been damaged or destroyed or something, and they want you to come back in. And that's why there is a warrant for your arrest. Sometimes they're so bold as to say that they sent you a letter telling you about this, right? Well, please, and then they tell you one of the important things they tell people, and that will give you a tip that this is a scam, is they say, don't hang up. I mean, I don't know about you, but if anybody doesn't tells me don't hang up, the first thing I'm going to do is hang up. And quite frankly, that's what I recommend to you as well. Hang up the phone, right? Because before this phone call is over, they're going to ask you for money. And they're going to ask you, come meet me in a certain place. More likely, I understand, they ask to go get a gift card. And then you're going to end up reading the code on the back of the gift card to them. Sometimes it's buying cryptocurrency. I mean, they're very clever and they're very creative. So, and I'll just tell you, the bottom line is this: whether, Ellie and I are both great attorneys and we have wonderful success rates, we will not be able to get your money back. If you give money to the scammers, that money will be gone forever. And I know of one individual in Los Angeles County who gave them $10,000. Okay, they're not talking for $10. They're only talking for $100. They're basically asking you for thousands of dollars. And they won't do that in the beginning of the call, is my understanding, but they will get you all worked up, we say. They're working really hard to get an emotional response from you. And they identify themselves as law enforcement, either a detective or sometimes just a police sergeant, whatever it is. Those folks are scammers. And the easiest thing to do is hang up on them. So I don't know if anybody has any questions or any questions about scammers, but debt, but please, 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 if somebody is saying something to you that doesn't sense, understand that doesn't make sense. Ellie, do you want to add something here about the scammers?
No, but it happens to people who are not on the registry. Anybody with a criminal conviction, and I get calls all the time from one person in particular. I don't know how his phone number has gotten to these scammers, but he calls me up, and somebody's calling from a office saying there's a warrant for your arrest. Please come in or pay, a couple $100. It's a scam.
Right. Folks, if a warrant has been issued for your arrest, guess what? They're going to come and pick you up. They're not going to say, oh, well, you can kind of buy your way out of this by paying me money. So it's a scam. Just hang up on them. That's the easiest thing to do. Okay, so let's move on. We have quite a few issues, and I'm going to tell you that the rate of time we spend talking about California issues is going to be higher this time, because we have an emergency that needs to be addressed. So, but let's go ahead and go through the nationwide issues first. One of them is SORNA. So SORNA regulations. I hope you all know that the federal government passed something called SORNA regulations. And hold on one minute, I've got to stop somebody's video. Okay. With SORNA regulations, these were regulations that were issued by the federal government, right? Actually, specifically the Attorney General's office. And they have terrible, terrible provisions in there. I mean, things like if you're going to spend more than X number of days away from your home, you're going to have to go and notify the law enforcement office where you currently register. In California, you don't have to do that. In California, you only have to notify if, in fact, you're permanently moving. Okay, so you can go on a visit for 2 days, 2 weeks, 2 months, and you don't have in California, again, unless you're on parole, probation, or supervised release, you don't have to tell your registration office. Okay, but SORNA regulations are proposed, that actually they're in effect, change that dramatically. So SORNA, it's very strange situation. There are only 18 states in our country that are in fact SORNA compliant, that abide by SORNA 100%. Other states like California is like, no way, we're not going to do that. Okay, so we're talking about only about one third of the states where SORNA is applied right now or is effective. But the fact is, it's a really awful, heavy cloud, that if it were implemented in every state, it would be just egregious. Here's another example. If in fact you have a passport, if you have more than one passport because you're a dual citizen, you would have to give them, law enforcement, that information. We have people right now already who have dual passports. And guess what? You don't have to tell people if you're in a non-SORNA state, you don't have to tell law enforcement you have a second passport. If you choose to travel on that second passport, oh well, right? So anyway, there's some really terrible provisions. I guess another category of provisions under the SORNA regulations are have to do with internet identifiers. I think that's the term that they use, internet identifiers. And so, I mean, what does that even mean? What is an internet identifier? There's no really legal definition for an internet identifier. It could be, what is your password on Amazon when you buy a roll of socks, or you or I don't know, wheelbarrow. But the fact is that these are the kind of provisions that are in SORNA. So Axol, from the very beginning, when these regulations were just draft regulations, we have spoken out against them. We're very much opposed to the SORNA regulations, because we believe that they violate people's civil rights up one side and down the other. And so there's another organization, not Axol, that has filed a lawsuit challenging those regulations. Okay. The name of that organization is Pacific Legal Foundation. And Pacific Legal Foundation is a very well-resourced organization. Is that a way to say they have a lot more money in the bank than Axol does? And not only that, they have a lot of attorneys, more attorneys than we do. They have 50 plus attorneys. And then on top of that, they have been to the U.S. Supreme Court several times. I believe the latest count was 17 times. They've argued cases before the U.S. Supreme Court. And guess what? They've won 14 of the 17. I think that's just a remarkable record. So when they approached Axol and asked us if we would be a plaintiff in their lawsuit, trust me, we said yes with an exclamation point. So we're dogging this legislation, litigation rather. They're the ones who are litigating, and we are a plaintiff in the case. There's also a few individuals who are plaintiffs in the case. So one of the things that's happened as a result of the litigation is, and this is litigation in federal district court, is in fact that the judge in the case, Judge Bernal, and by the way, this is in San Bernardino of all places. It went to the Central District. That's where the case was filed. And the Central District is pretty large. I thought it would end up in downtown Los Angeles, but instead it's out in San Bernardino. But the bottom line is this: Judge Bernal is a fair judge. I've appeared before him before, and I find him to be a fair judge. He's also brave. Having said that, his bravery only goes so far. So the reason I'm saying it that way is when it came to temporary restraining order in the case, he did issue a temporary restraining order. And folks, that's a big deal. Federal district court judges are very stingy with their TROs. And so the fact that Judge Bernal was willing to issue a TRO in this case is remarkable and a fabulous thing. Having said that, his TRO is limited to registrants in the state of California. So right now, registrants in the state of California do not have to comply with the SORNA regulation, which is good. And I see, Michael, your hand is up. Do you have a question, Michael? Kirsten, maybe you're just stretching. Okay, so and folks, at any time, if you do have a question or a comment, you can literally put your hand up as long as I can see you here, or you can do it through the buttons on the bottom of the bottom. One of them says raise hand. Used to anyway. I'm losing it, but anyway, I think you can find it when you're not talking. That you can raise your hand that way. Again, if you have a question or you have a comment. So Bernal in Riverside, not San Bernardino. I think so. And I think, well, yes, Ellie, you're right. You're Riverside. Okay.
Those two counties are the same in my, feeling.
I agree. They're both out in the hinterlands and in the desert. Okay. So, but still, I want to be precise. So thank you for that correction. Dan
Oh,
has his hand. Let's ask Dan to unmute himself. Dan?
Hi.
Hi.
Yes. I live in New York, which I understand is non-SORNA compliant. Is it still the common wisdom to follow the 7-day reporting, even though it's non-SORNA compliant? That's what I've been doing.
Well, Dan, so many times when I talk to clients, I say, look, there's a spectrum of risk here, and you have to decide where on the spectrum you're comfortable. So the most you're doing, Dan, the most conservative thing, which is acting as if the regulations apply to you. And I understand why you do that. I could, on the other hand, make a legal argument that, no, you don't have to comply with that requirement because you're not in a SORNA compliant state. And folks, the biggest issue in this lawsuit that's pending is to whom do these regulations apply, right? And trust me, it's a big deal. The answer to that question is a big deal. And it was really interesting that the government attorney in this case said, oh, well, everybody knows who these regulations apply to. And my understanding, because I wasn't there, is the judge said, really? I don't understand. So please educate me. Right. Yeah, it's not clear whether Dan, who lives in New York State, and which is a non-compliance, non-compliant state like California, do you have to comply with these or you don't? And folks, what we don't want to happen is we don't want you to get violated, and end up in federal prison, because that's the ultimate punishment for people who do not comply with the SORNA regulations, is up to 10 years in federal prison. And we don't want that to happen to you. Ellie, want to add anything about SORNA here?
No, I you did it well, and I'm just hoping that this lawsuit can be expanded to other states and not just California and at some point in the future.
Yeah, so I expect that to happen. I do. What I also expect to happen is when the judge, this federal district court judge in Riverside, makes his final decision, I think it's going to be, I'm like 100% sure it will be appealed. Whatever he decides, if he either decides on, benefit of the government, or if he basically decides in our favor, it will be appealed. And it will be appealed up to the Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals, which will mean that it will set precedent. And I'm okay with that. I'm really okay with that, I say, because I'm an optimist. I, don't know the Ninth Circuit that well. I couldn't tell you precisely, what I expect them to do, except I expect justice in most situations. So folks, if you have a questionable video, I'm gonna stop it. Please, please, please. We don't need to see your feet. We don't need to see your phone twirling around. It's very disruptive. So I will just stop your video. Okay, but you can still hear us, so that's a good thing. Okay. And if you really want to get admitted again, then please hang up and try again. Okay, so Jeff B just asked, is the case moving at all or dormant at this time? Yes, it is moving slowly, like a glacier, I think. And I do believe that this federal district court judge is being very, very careful in his actions and his decisions because he knows this case is going to be taken up on appeal to the Ninth Circuit. And judges at every level do not want to be overturned. Okay, so he's, I'm sure, dotting every I and crossing every T to make sure that he gives the best decision that he can. So I will say too that Molly Nixon is the attorney right now at Pacific Legal Foundation, who is leading their team of litigators, and she has already agreed to speak at our conference this year. So I hope, if you don't already know, the Axel conference will be on Friday, September 20th, and Saturday, September 21st. We're going to have a virtual conference this year for a variety of reasons, most of which is to allow more people from more states to join the conference. So again, it's September 20 and September 21, and it will be virtual. And actually, Molly Nixon is going to be the first speaker at the conference, and she's really looking forward to the opportunity. For those of you who attended last year's conference, we did have a different attorney there at Pacific Legal Foundation. Caleb Krukenberg is his name, and he just won everybody over, I believe, in his presentation. So please join us on September 20 and 21. We will be putting the dates out and allow people to sign up for the conference online and by phone as well. And I want you all to know that I believe language is extremely important. Therefore, I will never ask you to register for anything. And I hope you notice when I mentioned the conference, I said sign up for the conference. I think that is a bad word now, R, registered. Okay, that's the R word in my vocabulary, and I avoid it if at all possible. So anyway, please sign up for the conference when in fact it's possible to do so. It's not possible to do so yet because we're still inviting people to come speak. Okay, so that's does anybody else have a question or a comment about SORNA before we move on to travel, which is always an important topic, especially during the summer? Okay, very good. Okay, so let's talk about travel. It is summertime, and a lot of us like to travel during the summer. For some people who have children in school, that's the only time you can travel with your kids and stuff without getting in trouble with the school district. So let's talk about it. First, I want to talk about domestic travel, and then I want to talk about overseas travel. And again, if you have a question, like traveled overseas, you've traveled domestically, either you met a challenge somewhere or you were able to find a solution, please share that with us this morning. Okay, so let's talking about domestic travel. The sad and unfortunate thing is that every single state has different requirements for people on the registry who visit their states. Okay, the worst state is Rhode Island. They basically say if you come and stay in Rhode Island for more than 24 hours, you're going to have to register there. Well, we don't want you to register, anywhere other than where you permanently reside, and that makes sense when we talk about overseas travel a little bit more. But please, folks, it's to your advantage to register in as few states as possible. Okay, so what happened in Rhode Island? The good thing is it's a small state, right? And so there are a few things. Maybe there's more than a few things to see in Rhode Island, or maybe you have family members who live in Rhode Island. Well, if you do, then my strong recommendation is get a hotel room outside of Rhode Island, right? So you have a place to go to at night and sleep. And so then when you leave the state of Rhode Island, and it's per visit. So the fact is you go and visit the state of, go visit Aunt Sally for Thanksgiving, and she lives in Rhode Island. Great. Okay. But go to a hotel outside the state and sleep, and then go back to Aunt Sally's house the next day. So the clock keeps resetting in Rhode Island. The probably, because it's a small state, maybe there aren't so many people that want to go to Rhode Island to visit or for any other reason. But the states that are the most problematic, quite frankly, are Florida and and Nevada. Okay. So in both of those states, you have to register after 48 hours. And yes, I mean 48 hours. And yes, I mean the entire state of Florida. And yes, the entire state of Nevada. And the reason I say it that way, believe it or not, I get calls from time to time saying, well, I want to go to, you know, I want to go to Las Vegas and then I'm going to go to Reno. And I'm only going to spend 2 days in each of those places. Well, guess what? 2 plus 2 does equal 4. And guess what? You have triggered the requirement to register. So remember I talked earlier about risk and risk being a spectrum. It's the same thing with this. I have had people tell me, I went to Vegas for a week and nothing bad happened. I'm happy for that person, right? But it's kind of like, what if you run a red light and you don't get caught? Did you still break the law? Yeah. Did you get caught? No. Okay, good for you. But the fact is that you could get caught the next time. And when you don't register in a state, when there's a requirement to register, you have just failed to register. And guess what? Failures to register can, in fact, weigh you down legally and otherwise in the future. So please, please, please don't register in any more states than you need to. And in order to not register in any extra states, then please, please, please pay attention to what the registration requirements are in that state. There's a couple of places, the District of Columbia, by the way, you can visit D.C. For time, you know, as long as you want to. You can visit D.C. as long as you want to without triggering the requirement to register. Go look at all those beautiful monuments. Go to the Smithsonian, each and every one of their museums. You know, okay, folks, if you're not speaking, mute yourself. Okay, please mute yourself. We heard from at least one individual there. I'm looking quickly to see if other people are not muted. I hear some background noise. Okay, whenever you keep yourself unmuted and you're not speaking, unfortunately, it does cause some interference in the recording as well as in person speaking. So, all right, thank you, everybody. So I was talking about the length of time. Okay, Washington, D.C., you can visit D.C. There's no limit when you have to register. I called up the DC registration office myself, actually more than once. Okay, because when I first called them and they said there's no requirement to register, I was like, is that really true? And anyway, I kept calling and the answer kept remaining the same. Oh, by the way, I read their law as well. Now, one of the interesting things is when I talked to the folks at their registration office, this is what they said. Well, there's no requirement to register, but we really wish that they'd call us and let us know that they are there. You know what I told my client? Don't you dare. Don't call them. If there's no legal requirement to notify them, then don't call. Okay. So that's my opinion about Washington, D.C. The state that I know that had, other than D.C., that has the longest period of visitation is Hawaii. So you can go to Hawaii for up to 10 days, go to some luau's, go, you know, surfing, whatever reason that you want to go to Hawaii. And I highly recommend it. The fact going to Hawaii, that is, don't stay there for more than 10 days, because if you stay there for more than 10 days, you're going to have to register. And by the way, they also have a cumulative registration requirement, which is it's either 10 days per trip or 30 days per calendar year. Okay. So, you know, maybe in California, that's more doable than somebody from the East Coast. For us, it's only a 5-hour flight. But the fact is that maybe that's more doable. But whatever it is, folks, just be really careful that you don't stay long enough in any one state to trigger the requirement to register. Now, somebody last month brought up something, and I want to repeat it because I thought this is a really clever idea. If you like to travel by train, guess what? You're never going to be in a location long enough to have to register there. Unless the train breaks down, then you'll have to make other arrangements. But the fact is that trains travel through, right, the state, and guess what? You're not going to have to register. Looks like Michael has his hand up. Michael, could you unmute yourself, sir?
Hi, Janice. Michael Skuer. I could be wrong about this, but I believe Oregon has no limit on your visitation. Just wanted to mention.
All right. Well, thank you for that. I don't know that to be true. So one person, whoever's listening to this, the recording and stuff, please check before you go. But Oregon is a lovely place to visit as well. So I hope indeed it's true. Okay. So how about other comments and questions here about travel domestically? And I will say, while I'm waiting for hands to go up, that one of the things that makes my blood run cold is when somebody says, I'm going to get an RV and travel all over the country. And somebody who's required to register, you know, is it possible to do that? Yes, it is. But please, folks, do your homework before you do it. Again, you don't want to trigger a registration requirement in another state, you know, because if you are found in that state, guess what? what's going to happen. They're going to, you know, they could drag you into jail. They can bring you back. They can charge you with a felony. They could convict you of a felony. And guess what? Off to jail or prison you go. So I don't know about you, but I'd like to avoid that if possible. But it's all about the spectrum of the scare. Okay. So David has asked this question. What is the risk of registering? Okay. Let's talk about that. Under the international Megan's law, and that affects overseas travel, under IML, the IML only applies to people who are currently required to register in at least one state. And so many states, including California now, there's an opportunity for some people at least to petition for removal from the registry. Okay. So let's just say you're in California, you successfully petition for removal from the registry, okay, well, then the International Megan's Law doesn't apply to you. Oh, oops, except for the fact that you're also on Florida registry. So the Florida, there are states like Florida and New York, those are the two biggest states where they never take you off their registry. And Florida is particularly awful because they don't even take dead people off their registry. I mean, family members have tried to do that in court, and the courts have agreed that the state of Florida can list dead people on their registry. So think about the IML and whether or not it applies to you. And again, if you're required to register in even one state, it applies to you. Okay. And, well, plus you were convicted of an offense involving a minor. And remember, this is the federal definition of minor under 18. Even if it's a non-contact, non-violent offense like possession of child pornography, okay, that the IML will apply to you. So what we're trying to do is trying to help you navigate, right? I think sometimes like the registry and all the laws and the regulations are kind of like a pinball game. And I'm sure there are many people here who play pinball better than I do. But anyway, every once in a while I get brave and try to play pinball. And, you know, and the thing is, sometimes you hit bad things, right? It's not just good. And then the lights go off and the bells go off and you get points. There's also bad things, like basically that ball gets flushed down the toilet. So that's where I usually go. So the fact is that we're trying to help you navigate successfully through all these laws and regulations. And that's why, indeed, I say things like, please don't register in more than one state, if at all possible. And folks, I know that sometimes it's not possible to avoid it. I mean, it was a really sad situation one time when, you know, one of my clients had a father who was on his deathbed, and he said, you know what, I'm going to be there for my dad. I don't give a darn. I'm going to register. And it was in Florida. So he did register in Florida. And so he's burdened by the fact he's registered in Florida, as well as California. So please, please, please do your best not to register it in more than one state. Let me look at another chat here. What is IML? IML is the International Megan's Law. Thank you for answering that question, Michael S. Can you please clarify for me? I have heard different answers. If someone comes off the registry in a state such as California and later went to move to another state, do they then have to go on the registry in the new state? The answer is it depends. It depends on the state to which you are moving. And folks, if you're planning to move, you know, if you have been removed, let's make this more generic. If you've been removed from the registry in one state, be very, very careful about the state to which you are moving. And I'm absolutely serious about this because each state has their own registration requirements. Now, some states say, oh, if you're not required to register in the state that convicted you, then you don't have to register here. That's some states. Other states say, if you've ever been required to register in any state, you're required to register in our state. And guess what? And then there's everything in between those two things. Sometimes it depends upon what you were convicted of. Sometimes it depends upon how long you were in prison. So I cannot answer that for you. And again, if you're seriously considering moving to another state, check in with a lawyer from the state to which you're moving. This is really, really important. Okay. And it's not going to take 5 minutes for that person to make the decision. Sometimes it gets down to, believe it or not, the elements of the crime, right? So you would think, well, I got convicted of, let's say, sexual battery in California, but not every state has an offense called sexual battery. And oh, by the way, even in California, sexual battery can be a felony or it can be a misdemeanor. So it's not clear. There's not an easy answer. And by the way, I love it when people call me and say, I have an easy question. And I think to myself, chances are the answer will not be easy, but the question's easy. So anyway, the other thing is, this is just a tip, folks. If you're going to call me or any other lawyer, make sure you have pen and and paper handy right there. Okay. So I'm going to give you some information in a phone call. Have pen and paper handy. Don't say, oh my God, I have to go across the room or I've got to go to my car or whatever. You know what? You're wasting our time, and our time is very precious. And I'm willing quite often to give you free time. Okay. But don't waste my time. So if you're going to call me, and Ellie, you can let me know if you agree. When you call, please have paper and pen or pencil handy. Ellie?
That's right. And sometimes I get emails and it takes a while for me to respond, but I will respond. And I know there's a few people on this meeting I need to respond to. And don't worry, some of them I'm still researching. So sometimes the answer takes some research.
And sometimes it's a lot of research. And when it's a unique situation, and what I mean by that, the answer only applies to you, right? It takes more research than otherwise. So let's go ahead and move on to the topic of overseas travel. We kind of have already. So let's talk about it. Basically, what the International Megan's Law says is if you were convicted of an offense involving a minor and you're currently required to register in even one state, then you have to do two things. One, you have to provide your local law enforcement office with a 21-day notice, at least 21 days. I always recommend 30 days because sometimes they can't count. And the other thing is that the federal government has the right to add a, quote, unique identifier to your passport, a unique identifier. What the hell does that mean? Well, this is what, and I'm paraphrasing, a unique identifier is something that says this person has been convicted of a sex offense involving a minor. And what does that mean? There's no definition. What is a sex offense? Who is a minor? You know, how long ago was this person convicted? None of that other information is there. So guess what? Many times when government officials in other countries see that language, they think the worst. You know, they might have an age of consent of 12 and they're like, oh my God, this person, you know, basically molested an 8-year-old. You know what? It may not be true, but they don't know that. And then the other thing is they don't know how long ago you were convicted, right? And so I always think of Frank Lindsay, who was on the registry for 44 years. All right. He avoided having that added to his passport only because he did not renew his passport for about 5 years. Okay. He recently did renew his passport because he's no longer required to register in any state. So somebody here asked, if you're off the tiered registry but have an offense involving a minor, does IML apply to you? Only if you are required to register in any state. So if you're off the registry completely, then the IML doesn't apply to you. Okay. So that's the good news. And, you know, that's why Ellie and I and Jeff Stein, when he's here, by the way, Jeff is traveling on vacation right now. But the fact is that's why we keep saying avoid registration in more than one state. Okay. That's how clear it is, because you could basically have the IML apply to you even if you're off the register in the state of conviction. So this is a good time if people have questions or comments, perhaps, about international travel. I know that we have a board member who now is no longer on the California registry, and he's no longer on the Florida registry. And so his life has gotten simpler because the International Megan's Law no longer applies to him. And by the way, if you're interested in finding out about how to get a Florida registry, I don't do that, but I know an attorney in Florida who has done it and did it for our fellow board member. It's unusual. It took some doing. I'm sure it cost that board member some money as well to pay to an attorney, but it can't be done. So, all right. So let's talk about the fact that if the International Megan's Law applies to you, it's going to be hard for you to travel overseas in that there are countries that will not allow you in the country, regardless of how long it's been, regardless of it was a non-contact, non-violent offense like possession of child pornography. For example, the countries on the continent of Asia will not allow you to enter. Please understand that. You want to go to Philippines, they're not going to let you in. You want to go to Japan, they're not going to let you in. You want to go to China, they're not going to let you in. Please, please avoid all the trouble, headache, and expense of traveling to a country that won't let you in. And I mean, to the point, they will not let you out of the airport. So here's a real live example. Had a client, he's a U.S. citizen living in Long Beach, married to a woman who is a Japanese citizen. So she wanted to go buy a house in Japan. Now, this is going to be their second residence, not their first. And so he said, okay, let's go to Japan and let's go find a house. He was able to fly to Tokyo, but he never was allowed to leave the airport. So that man, in some respects, saved himself a lot of money because he didn't buy a house in Japan, but his wife was not pleased, let's put it that way. So he could not get out of the airport in Tokyo. There's a hotel in the Tokyo airport. He was mandated to stay in that hotel room, in the hotel room, all right? I guess he could get room service so he didn't starve, but he was basically kept in that hotel room at his own expense, by the way, until he could get on another flight and come back to the United States. Here's another story. A businessman who basically got a big contract from a company in Korea. He bought a ticket to go to Seoul, South Korea on business. And he tried to print his boarding pass, you know, from home, and that didn't work. And he thought, well, there's just a problem with my computer. Then he went to the airport, went to the kiosk and tried to print his boarding pass there, and it still wouldn't print. So he went to the counter, and this is what they said. We're not going to give you a boarding pass. We're not even going to let you on this flight because South Korea will not allow you. Folks, why would you do that to yourself? Why is Janice saying this one more time? I know I sound like a broken record, but I get the saddest phone calls from people who've saved up their money for a long time, travel overseas, only to be denied entry. So if you can't go to Asia, where can you go? I'm happy to report you can go to Europe. Okay. Most of Europe is open to people on the registry. Bellucci is my maiden name. Bellucci, I am Italian, and I'm happy to report that the country of Italy is happy to welcome you. I tease people and say with a bottle of red wine and some pasta, not really, but it'll be nearby. So go to Europe. Okay. Go to Europe. Europe is a lovely place. There's 26 countries in Europe called the Schengen nations. Some of them are small countries, but some of them are large. So the large countries are Italy, Spain, France, and Germany. All right. They will allow you to enter the country. They will welcome you as visitors. And guess what? While you're there, nobody's going to ask you, were you convicted of a sex offense? Now, there is a small part of Europe you need to avoid, and that is the United Kingdom. Okay. Don't go to the United Kingdom. You will be denied entry there. What am I talking about? I'm talking about England and Ireland and Scotland. Okay, at this point in time, they're not allowing people who are required to register to enter their countries. I'm sad to say. Okay, so again, you can make your own choices. You can travel to Europe. And by the way, we had a person who just went through Heathrow Airport in which is in London, and he was on his way to another destination. So Heathrow was just, he had to leave the plane and he was going to board the plane to the next location. He never was planning to leave the airport. They found out in London at the Heathrow Airport, he was on the registry. They made him go back to the United States. So, folks, they're not kind there. I think England, I mean, we've had a registry much longer than England, but they're crazy. I think they're even crazier than the United States when it comes to the registry. So, okay. So, by the way, there's some updated information here about Oregon and visiting. So please look there. And it says that state law does not specifically address visitors, but if you're moving there, you have 10 days before you have to register. Okay, so it seems like maybe there's some ambiguity there, but I appreciate the person who brought up Oregon as a possibility, and that's, of course, domestic travel. So, so I mentioned two continents so far. I've mentioned Asia, off limits. I've mentioned Europe, green light for most of the countries. Other continents, Australia, I would never go to Australia. I'll tell you why. In Australia, they won't even let some of their registrants out of the country. Australia is an island. I'm like, how could you not let people off of your island? I don't know. This just seems crazy to me. But anyway, don't go visit Australia. As far as going to Central America, that's iffy. Okay. It's iffy. There are some countries that allow you, some that don't. I know one man who probably wouldn't otherwise have been allowed to enter a Central American country. He was fluent in Spanish. And they said, oh, sure. Come on in. Right. Here's a taco and some tequila. I'm teasing. But the fact is, you know, there are some friendly countries out there. They love the United States. They love American tourists, right? We spend a lot of money when we travel. And so most countries want to allow America to come in to travel, but it's it's our government's fault. It's the U.S. government's fault, because this is what happens. Remember I said the thing about giving a notice of at least 21 days? Law enforcement, okay, that's who you're notifying. Well, then local law enforcement, they send that information to the federal government, okay? And then our U.S. government sends a notice to the country to which you're traveling. What, right? And so they get the same kind of notice that's on the unique identifier on the passport. This person's been convicted of a sex offense involving a minor. And again, they don't say what the age of the victim was. They don't say if any violence was involved. They don't say how long ago the person was convicted, anything like that. And so I think that many countries, out of an abundance of caution, say, oh, okay, we don't want this person coming to visit our country because maybe they're going to, you know, abuse our children or women. So, okay. Yeah. But I really do blame our country. I don't blame the other countries, believe it or not. So if, you know, just think about it. If you were a country and you received a notice that this person had been convicted of a sex offense involving a minor and nothing more, yeah, and erring in the side of caution, maybe you wouldn't allow them in either. Africa, there are some countries in Africa that do allow registrants to visit. I can't tell you off the top of my head who that was. I'm sorry, looking at chat there. I can't tell you with any certainty which countries in Africa allow registrants to visit. I hope South Africa is one of them. If anybody knows, would you please put it in the chat room there? Because I visited South Africa. I absolutely adore elephants, and I got to see elephants in the preserve there, and it's a highlight of my life, quite frankly. So anyway, and by the way, they have good white wine too, and good European food. So here I am. I'm a travel agent for South Africa. I had a very positive experience. So anyway, unless you all have some questions here about overseas travel, we're going to move on. Let's take a moment. If anybody wants to put their hand up, and you can do that. Did they change the buttons on the bottom, folks? Because I'm having trouble finding the put your hand up. Is that the react? Yeah. Okay. So it says react down at the bottom of my screen. If you want to raise your hand, you press the react button. Here, I'll raise my hand. Ta-da! And also will be put you in the beginning. So now I'm going to lower my hand. But anyway, this is the time if you have a comment or question about any kind of travel at this point, whether it's domestic or overseas. And Jim has his hand up. Welcome, Jim. And then he left. I don't know if that was...
Okay, I'm unmuted. The question is, some states and some countries, I've heard, base their opinion upon a conviction, not upon registration. Is there, if you're no longer required to register, could you travel to the UK, for example?
I don't know, but one of our board members is going to find out soon because he's doing that. So the International Megan's Law says registration is a requirement. Okay, but... But I'm not sure that's absolutely, it's a requirement for those two things, the 21-day notice and the unique identifier, okay? And what I do for my clients that I get off the registry, and by the way, so far 103 of my clients are no longer required to register, including a couple of people who are joining us today. They don't have to comply anymore with International Megan's Law. But so I notify the Department of Homeland Security when a court has granted an order terminating their requirement to register. And this is the response I get back from the Department of Homeland Security, so from the federal government. Number one, no, this person is no longer required to give a 21-day notice. Number two, this person, you know, we will not add a unique identifier to this person's passport. And number three, but we reserve the right to notify any country to which they're traveling. So doesn't that beg the question, how do they know you're traveling if you haven't sent the notified your local government? So it's obvious to me that the federal government is keeping track of people who used to register, okay? And maybe they're sending notices to which you travel. I don't know. So as far as a country then that receives that notice and what they choose to do, it's really up to that country. And I haven't heard if anybody yet, but I'm serious. We do have a board member who is going to a family wedding this summer, and it is in the United Kingdom. He's no longer required to register. And so we'll see if he's successful getting to the family wedding. He has a plan B, in case he does. Chris has hand up. Chris Nugent, please unmute yourself. Chris. Your hand is up. Okay, well, while Chris is trying to mute himself, I'm guessing that's the problem. There's some questions here about contacting me. So I'm going to put here in the chat room my contact information. And I'm going to warn you all that I'm going to be only available on Monday of the coming week. And that is because I'm going to St. Louis for a trial. I'll be talking about that more. Okay. Chris, one more chance here. Okay. All right. Well, if he has a question, I'm just looking to, okay, Marty just wrote in the chat room. Oh, Chris says it's not letting him unmute. Let me click on ask to unmute Chris, see if that helps you. Clicking on it. Is that helping Chris? No. Okay. David's got his hand up. So let's ask David now and maybe Chris will figure out his. Yep.
Real quick, I want to ask about Israel. Do they allow entry?
Yes.
Thank you.
Yeah. I have a client who's gone to Israel several times. Gerald, do you have your hand up, sir? Go ahead.
Yeah. Do you know anything about El Salvador?
I don't know about El Salvador. Since that's part of Central America. Central America, some people have gotten in and some people have not. And we lost a really valuable resource, folks, and it's a really terrible story. There was a gentleman who had a website. He's not an attorney, but, you know, he traveled pretty extensively. He's on the registry, and he traveled pretty extensively overseas, and he other people communicated with him through our website and other sources, and he was keeping track. I remember specifically about Central America. Unfortunately, he has been convicted of a subsequent sex offense, and he's currently in custody. He's in federal prison. So I don't know, David, and I don't even know how you can find out. Maybe if you go to our website, there's an ongoing dialogue about international travel, and I think if you were to ask that question on our website, that you'd get an answer. Though I'm sorry, I don't know. And Chris, your hand is still up.
Janet,
yes.
This is Edgar from Pasadena.
Hello, Edgar.
I have a question. I just traveled for first time after my conviction. Mm-hmm. Came back a week ago to South America. When I returned into the United States, I went through a formal inspection. It went well. The woman who interviewed me said, your passport is not annotated. And I said, what does that mean? And she said, well, it's not annotated. So I don't know what she meant. Do you know what that means?
I think she was letting you know that your passport does not have a unique identifier on it. And so let me go back to the International Megansaw and talk about what the IML says about it. Okay. So the IML basically says that, that the State Department has the authority to add a unique identifier to the passport of anybody who's currently required to register and their offense involved a minor. Okay. And it says that when you apply for a new passport, that the State Department shall, not may, but shall, that means they will, they're supposed to, add a unique identifier to your passport. Having said that, I know people who've applied for passports, new passports, and the unique identifier was not added to their passport, right? And believe it or not, I think that poses a danger for the person who's traveling, because your passport could be revoked at any moment, okay? And I do mean at any moment. And so another sad story, and Chris will get right to you. I'm happy to see your face there. a gentleman who was traveling with his wife, and they were going to go to Europe for an extended period of time. He consulted with me. They were going to Schengen nation. Everything was set. And, you know, their bags had been checked. And they were literally sitting in their seats on the airplane when a federal government official came and tapped him on the shoulder and told him he had to get off the plane because his passport had been revoked. And the reason it was revoked is because it didn't have a unique identifier on it. Well, that was news to him. He did not know his passport had been revoked. At least that's what he told me. So there's a lot of angst. And by the way, they lost a lot of money because they had paid for lodging in Europe and they weren't able to take advantage of it. So that's what could happen if you're supposed to have a unique identifier and you don't. All right, Chris, you've been very patient, sir.
Okay. I'm trying to do a Princess cruise from Florida to the Bahamas, Puerto Rico, and the Virgin Islands, which are territories of the United States. So will that be a problem?
Possibly. And the problems, the potential problems start with the cruise line. There are some cruise lines that will not let you to enter a cruise ship if, in fact, you're required to register.
Princess isn't one of those, so that's not a problem.
Okay. Well, then, as far as the other ones, why don't you contact contact me offline and I can try to help guide you. I don't think that Puerto Rico is part of the United States. So I don't think that. And so is, well, St. Thomas, is that?
It's a territory.
Okay. Then that's going to be fine too. So the Bahamas, I don't know. Princess K's Bahama. Is Bahama part of the name of the ship?
No. Princess K's is the island that Princess itself owns. It's in the Bahamas.
Yeah. But Chris, I know sometimes what happens on these ships too is if they allow you on the ship and you just said the Princess line does, then it's possible that they won't let you off the ship, right? Like okay. If you go to Bahamas, but they would let you stay on the ship while you know, your family or whoever you're traveling with goes on shore if they want to. But I'm pretty sure Puerto Rico and Virgin Islands won't be a problem.
Okay. And did you say there's a way I could contact you off this?
Yes. If you look in the chat, I put my contact information there.
Okay. Awesome. Okay. All right. And the only thing I would have to do beforehand, you're saying, is contact my local authority 21 days and let them know that I'm traveling?
Yes.
Okay.
I assume, Chris, that you're required to register in at least one state. Is that true?
California. Yes.
Okay. All right. I'm sorry that you're registering here, but okay. All right. So somebody else asked about Canada. Canada doesn't let registrants come in if you've been convicted of a felony sex offense. And, you know, I really am upset that any country won't let a registrant come to visit. But Canada's kind of a different situation in that they don't let any felons come visit. So, you know, if you're convicted of murder, you're convicted of armed robbery, whatever it was, grand theft auto, they won't let you come visit unless you, in fact, get some special dispensation, which a Canadian attorney can help you with. And I know a Canadian attorney who's helped many people with that process. And so if you're interested, send me an email message and I can send you the contact information for that attorney. I don't want to put it in the chat. Okay. Okay. All right. So here we go. Somebody's comment. I'm a Filipino citizen, got caught stinging from an online sting operation that required me to register tier one. Could you please clarify if this means I will be unable to return to my home country indefinitely? The Philippines is definitely a country that will not let people in general visit that country. I think it might be possible if, in fact, you are a native Filipino and a Filipino citizen here. So contact me, if you would, separately by email, and I can refer you to an attorney who might be able to help you in the Philippines. I just don't know the answer to that question. But if you're not a Filipino citizen, I do know the answer to the question is you won't be allowed to enter.
Thank you.
All right. Okay. So, let us move on. And I don't know whether to give the good news first or the bad news. I like good news, so why don't we at least talk about one case that's settled recently that's going to help about 7,000 people on the registry. Before I do that, I think, if Jeff Stein were here, and I don't know, Ellie, if you're comfortable doing this, is kind of give an Excel commercial. So, folks, when we do this, we're doing this as volunteers, Ellie and I, and a lot of the rest of the work that we do as volunteers as well. So what we ask you to do is consider making a donation to the Alliance, and you can do that really easily by going to the Alliance website. I'll put the website address down below, or maybe Ellie, you could do that for me so I can keep talking. And therefore, it's really easy to make a donation that way. We have people who make donations of $5. Actually, this week we got a donation for $2,500. So everything in between. $2,500 is unusual and appreciated. Every donation, quite frankly, appreciated. Because again, we're an organization of volunteers, and the amount of work that we do and the issues that we cover is really, really, we're limited by our resources. So every extra dollar that we have means we can help more people. So please, please consider a donation. The best donations, thank you, Freddie, so I just donated. Basically, they don't see my contact information, so let me try this again. The best way is, in fact, to make a monthly donation. And we do, in fact, have people who donate, $5 a month, and that adds up. It's $60 for the year, right? So here we go. There's my contact information again. And so whatever it is that you can't afford, if you can't afford something, please consider a donation, either a one-time donation or a monthly donation. JJ, please. please unmute yourself.
Hello.
Hi.
Hi, Janice. I'm asking for my husband. I was wondering how you know whether your passport would be marked or not.
Oh, it's very obvious these days, fortunately. I hope you all know that our organization challenged the International Megan's Law. We were unsuccessful, unfortunately. And I'm bringing it up because in the beginning, the unique identifier was back in the endorsement pages of the passport, like page 27 or so, right? Now it's on the first page, the page one. So you open your passport, and page two is where your photo is and your passport number and the other information. But page one is your unique identifier. So it's very easy to tell.
Okay, thank you.
You're certainly welcome. And by the way, folks, when we challenged that, when we challenged the IML in Federal District Court, one of the things we said was that unique identifier is a scarlet letter, right? And literally the only two countries in the history of the world that have ever done something like that to their citizens are Nazi Germany and Russia. And in both cases, they basically marked passports of their Jewish citizens. That's the only time this has ever happened in the whole history of the planet. And we asked, literally, the judge is, and you want to approve something like this? You want the United States to join the club of Nazi Germany and Russia? And she said, yeah, sure. I mean, it was remarkable. And one of the arguments made at that time was, oh, the unique identifier is going to be in the, you know, back in the endorsement pages, and very few people will see it. Wrong. Now it's on page one, right? Now it's on page one. So I'm sorry. I get a little worked up about these.
Janice, can you hear me?
Yes. Who are you?
Hi, this is Bill Stevenson from Coalinga.
Oh, hi, Bill.
Hi.
Can I give the folks a little more information about who you are?
Oh, sure, sure.
Okay, so Mr. Stevenson is somebody, he lives in California. He's been designated as a sexually violent predator, and he's in Coalinga State Hospital. He's been trying to get out of the hospital for more than 2.5 years after the government said that he doesn't pose a danger. So 2.5 years now trying to get out. And Bill, I don't know if that's what you're going to talk about or something else, but please go ahead.
No, I wanted to stay on topic as far as the traveling goes. It's our understanding in here, and maybe quite likely we're misinformed, is that once we've been designated an SVP, at least as far as California is concerned, we stay on the registry marked as an SVP even after we've been discharged. Does that disqualify us from getting a passport from the State Department? And if we don't have a minor victim, do they identify us as, you know, I don't know, like a tier 1.5 or something?
I'd say you've been misinformed, okay? So I know people who have been released from Coalinga State Hospital who originally were identified as sexually violent predators, and they successfully completed their conditional release program, otherwise known as CONREP, and their SVP designation was basically ended at that point in time. So I think, number one, that when you finish your conditional release program, you will not have that designation anymore, and there's no recognition of SVPs under the federal law. So as long as your offense did not involve a minor, the IML would not apply to you.
Okay, so, but since we're lifetime registrants, we're still going to be banned from all of those other countries?
Well, not all of those countries. You'd still be able, certainly, to travel to the countries in Europe that I mentioned.
Okay, but the UK, the exclusionary countries, those would always be out of the question.
I don't like to use two words, never and always, okay?
Oh, so I understand.
Say today, it's true. Hopefully tomorrow it will not be true.
Okay.
Okay.
All right. Thank you.
You're very welcome. Thanks for joining us today. And by the way, the people at the hospital, the patients at the hospital, they do have access to the phone. So obviously that's why Mr. Stevenson
yeah,
called.
Some people may not like. I do have a room full of people here, so.
Oh, great.
We're participating.
Yeah. I'm glad you all heard what I had to say. Just to say too, one of the things that we do as an organization is we work with people. We help people like Bill Stevenson, who just spoke. And we filed a motion to intervene in his case because it's taken 2.5 years, right? And he still doesn't have housing in the community. And it's just a travesty. So we're going to try to help his public defender. Bruce, is that your name, sir? Do you have a question or comment? Bruce? Hi. Do you have a question or comment, Bruce? Your hand is up and you're unmuted. Go ahead.
That's Siri Rosa. My name is, you can hear me, Ms. Janice?
Yes, we can. I'm sorry. How do you pronounce your name?
Yeah, but that, guest last name is Rosen. That's my wife's last name. I'm on the computer.
Oh, okay. That's why you weren't responding. All right.
Okay. I get what you're saying. I'm from California, newly released from California State Prison a little over 60 days ago.
Congratulations.
Thank you. I'm just now learning my way around the computer. I want to get in the chat room, but I can't seem to send something on the chat. And I know I've been sitting here, and I know you guys wonder why I haven't spoken or introduced myself. So I just want to introduce myself. And as far as you, I've been following you for many years once I found out that you was a constitutional lawyer for sex offenders over almost 10 years ago. But for some reason, I never could get in contact with. And now, since I've been in abstinence therapeutic, I seen this on Zoom the other day, so I told myself I would come in and get on a chat and learn more about it and become a participant in it.
Well, welcome. We're glad you're here.
Okay. I'm really looking forward to being more spoken out because I know a lot of registrants, you know, it's either too embarrassed or to speak out or to step forward in helping to change some of these tough restrictions that they have on us. So I want to become part of someone that's willing to do that. You know, I have also noticed that many people have spoken in Congress, whether it be for drug laws or anything, but I've never heard anyone, inmate, go and speak before Congress in reference to committing a sexual offense after many years and how to get off of it and have some of the restrictions raised.
So, do you have a specific question this morning?
One of my questions is, after a year, is there a new law that requires after a year that we can be removed from
treatment?
Therapy?
Yes. Okay, so thank you. Let me speak to that if I can. So folks, when I was talking about good news, bad news, this is one of the good news stories. So we sued the California Department of Corrections. It's a big deal. They're a big agency. They have a lot of money and they have a lot of people. But you know what? David beat Goliath. So here we go. We sued them. All right. And the fact is we won. So when we sued the Department of Corrections, we said, you know, folks, this policy that you have that basically said this was an unwritten policy, but they were all complying with it. Their unwritten policy was that every registrant, the entire time they're on parole, had to undergo treatment. That was the unwritten policy. How did I find out about this unwritten policy? It's because I sued them on behalf of one person in San Mateo County here in California. And I thought it was going to be difficult to get this information from the CDCR employees who testified at that trial. And you know what? They weren't the least bit bashful about it. They said to the judge, yes, that is our policy. Every registrant the entire time they're on parole must undergo treatment. Huh. Some people in California are on parole for 20 years. Does this make sense for 20 years that somebody's going to have to undergo treatment? No. And the other thing is, to make matters even worse, is that people should, by law, must be considered for early discharge from parole. That's a different law. Okay. They must be considered, not necessarily granted, but considered for early parole. But the fact is, people were being denied early discharge from parole because guess what? They were undergoing treatment. So this is the tail wagging the dog. And we said, no, that's not what the law says, CDCR. You know, we're suing you. And that's what we did. And to CDCR's credit, and I don't use that term lightly because I don't give them much credit at all or credibility, CDCR called me, an attorney from that agency called me and said, you're right, we're breaking the law. Our policy is illegal. Thank you, David. Two thumbs up. I almost fell out of my chair because I've sued this agency many times before and they never admitted that they did anything wrong. Never. They always dug their feet in. They always said, nah, and we're not going to change. And by the way, in one of those cases, I went all the way up to the state Supreme Court. I got a unanimous decision in my favor, our favor really, that said CDCR was breaking the law. So this time they like, oops, yeah, you caught us again. And they ask us, what can we do to fix the matter? And I said, why don't you start with reading the law? So this is what the law says. Number one, the minimum amount of time a registrant must on parole must undergo treatment is 1 year. That's the minimum. If there's no statement about what maximum is, okay, just as the minimum is 1 year, so everybody's going to go through 1 year there. Number two, too. Then what's supposed to happen is that CDCR is supposed to make a decision about whether or not additional treatment is required. They're not doing that because remember that policy I just told you about that said the entire time of parole? That wasn't a case-by-case analysis. That was everybody on parole. Okay. And number three, it says that a Superior Court judge has the right to terminate treatment at any point in time. And I'll tell you what, in that case that I filed in San Mateo County, it was a beautiful thing to watch. We had a judge who had a backbone that day, who was smart and who was brave. And she said, that's it. No more treatment. That's it. And from that day on, that man had not ever have to undergo treatment. By the way, he had been in treatment for 6 years. And he had an experience that I think many people on parole have, which is the treatment provider changes. So CDCR is out there issuing contracts, ending contracts all the time. And what happened with him is there was a new treatment provider. The first treatment provider said, you're finished. You're complete. No more treatment for you, right? A new company got hired by CDCR. They contacted him and said, not only was he not finished, he was going to start from the beginning because we don't trust what that other company did. And it just really was upsetting to him and to me as well. And so we took him to court. By the way, it took a couple of years. There was some question about what the right county where he was supposed to, where the lawsuit was supposed to be filed. But anyway, we got it figured out. So now with the settlement agreement, and the settlement agreement is in writing, folks. This is a formal agreement. So CDCR is in the process of issuing brand new regulations. They're doing it on an emergency basis, which wasn't their idea. It was our demand. They're doing it on an emergency basis so that, again, all registrants on parole must complete the 1 year. After that, in a containment meeting, which means parole, treatment provider, and registrant, a decision is going to be made whether or not government thinks that you need further treatment. They're going to have to put that decision in writing, including the reason why, and then they have to give a copy of that decision to the person on parole. So all of these are specific points in the settlement agreement. And one of the reasons that it was so darn important to make sure that parolees got a copy of this decision is if they make a stupid decision, guess what? You can take them to court. And I hope you'll call me or another attorney. Okay. Emmy. I don't know if that's your name or
Emmy.
Emmy. Okay. Emmy. Yes. Do you have a question about this?
Yes. Is it a state or is it a county? What is it about the how long you go to treatment?
That's in California only. Our agreement is with the California Department of Corrections, but it is statewide in California.
Okay, so does every state have their own laws about the treatment?
I'm sure they do, yes.
And how do we find out what the actual amount is for my state? I'm in Missouri.
Okay. I'll be in Missouri next week, Emmy.
No.
Yeah, why don't you just contact me separately? I'll do my best to look it up, but if not, we'll find you a Missouri attorney. Okay.
Thank you.
You're very welcome. Okay, so one reason I'm so excited about that case is there are almost 7,000 people in the state of California who are both on the registry and on parole. So this decision should help that many people. And folks, I'm serious. If people, if this happens to you and they make a stupid decision, please contact an attorney because we have to hold their feet to the fire. Otherwise, it's just empty words. Okay. And trust me, I'm more than willing and able to do it. Lauren, your hand is up.
Yes. Hi, Janice. Can you hear me?
Yes.
Okay, perfect. First of all, of course, that's good news as far as parole and time and treatment. Is there anything as far as I'm currently supervised release with federal as far as guidelines? Because again, we're running across the same type scenario. I've been in treatment now 5 years, of course, with no incidents, no violations, no anything along those lines. Yet I can never seem to get an end date, if you will.
Yeah, let me stop you there.
Sure.
It doesn't, this settlement agreement doesn't apply to you. It's only state because it's a California Department of Corrections. But what you have just told me makes me very interested in thinking that I might need to file to the federal government. So please contact me.
Oh, I would love to. That would in any way I can help out. I'm not scared to put my name on anything, if you will.
Yeah.
But yeah, I do think people need to be held accountable. I have asked this question many, many times. I've gone through seven different probation officers in 5 years,
yeah,
and two different treatment facilities, quote unquote, because one lost the contract. So everything that you've mentioned before is exactly what's going on right now.
Well, and Lauren, you're telling me more than I've ever known about the federal system. It stinks to high heaven, and there's quite possible that there is an unwritten policy over there with the federal government as well, and I have no reservations on suing them. None. In fact, I would look forward to it.
Perfect. I'll shoot you an email, and of course, anytime that you have or whatever that we can sit down and, you know, via email, I would be very interested in speaking with you.
Yeah, trust me, I'll be interested in speaking to you as well.
Thank you, Dennis.
You're welcome. Hey, folks, you know, like, why do I take such delight in suing the California Department of Corrections? It's because they're government officials who are basically violating the law themselves. And for so long, these turkeys have gotten away with it, right? Because they knew that most people, individuals on the registry, don't have the resources to file a lawsuit on their own behalf. And that's why we're here. We are here for you. We're here to be your Davids with the slingshot. We're here to be, you know, to hold your hand figuratively, you know, through the emotional support group meetings and stuff like that. We're here for you. We're here to give you hope. And, you know, I know I talk about the law a lot because guess what? I'm a lawyer and I've been a lawyer for 41 years and I just see everything as a legal issue. I know that about myself. Okay. But the fact is there's a heck of a lot of legal issues that, out there that need to be fixed. And I'll just give you a little tiny bit of insight into why I'm a lawyer. I'm a lawyer because as a kid, I saw the movie To Kill a Mockingbird, right? It's a novel. It's fiction. And Atticus Finch, the character of Atticus Finch, inspired me, right? And, you know, it wasn't that long ago. Remember, I've been a lawyer for 41 years. I've only been doing this for 15 years. And you know, before I made the decision to wade into this, because trust me, most lawyers will not touch it with a 10-foot pole, I said, I don't know if I should be doing this or I shouldn't be doing this. But people keep tugging on my sleeve, wanting me to get involved in this. And I asked myself, what would Atticus do? And you know what? I said that in an interview one time, and some nice woman whose name I had long forgotten sent me needlepoint, and I'm looking at it right now. And it says, what would Atticus do? To remind me sometimes when it seems like there's so many challenges out there and I might be feeling overwhelmed, I just keep asking myself, what would Atticus do? And maybe get a cup of coffee or a piece of chocolate and move on. Okay, so enough about me. Jay, you've got your hand up. Let's try to unmute you. I know you spoke earlier, Jay. Worked. There we go. Jay.
Hi, can you hear me?
Yes.
Can you hear me?
Yes, Jay, we can hear you.
Hi. So speaking of corruption and all that, so my husband, I would assume that you might be familiar with the case, 2005, the Heidel Orange County gang rape, 17-year-old. That was the biggest trial in Orange County.
Can you hear me? Yes, please go ahead. Is that your husband? Was he convicted there?
Okay. So yeah, that's my husband. One of the boys. He was he was 17 at the time when it happened. So speaking of corruption, there was a lot of corruption in the whole case. The police department, the DA on both, and the lawyers on both sides. Like basically everyone that was involved in that case has gone down either in prison or died of natural causes, stuff like that. So I just about just going further with basically investigating what we're able to do due to the corruption of the whole basically court system failure that happened to them. I mean, they were underage and he's a lifetime registrant for 289E. So I'm just there, like I said, with all the corruption of the whole system that came out after the trial, I'm just curious of what, you know, direction you could go as far as the corruption stuff goes, like what point?
Well, I don't know. I'm not familiar with your husband's case, but Jay, I would be more than happy to talk to you privately. I think a private conversation would probably be the best way to go. Get started, okay?
Okay. Okay. Thank you.
You're welcome. David, you have your hand up? Would you like to unmute yourself? Let's see. Do I have to ask? There you go.
Yeah. I was wondering if there's any performance reporting requirement language in the settlement with CDCR.
I don't know what that means.
Well, what I mean by that is oftentimes these laws happen and CDCR needs to implement various things, but then they don't. That was my case while I was in prison. So often it's like the wolf guarding the hen house. It just didn't work. So is there any oversight?
Right. Yes. And here's the quick answer, we're going to sue the bastards, okay? So if they have agreed in writing that they're going to do something and they don't do them, we will sue them again.
But that would require those who are registered would and taking treatment, they would need to be knowledgeable of this to raise the issue.
We're doing the best we can to get the word out. I went to the California Sex Offender Management Board this meeting this week. Actually, it was 2 days ago. And when I was there, I passed out copies of settlement agreement. Okay. It's on our website. I mean, we're doing all we can. Each of you, some of you who are in treatment, maybe can tell people in your group and stuff that this is done. Some of the treatment providers don't know about this yet. Okay. And that's okay, but they're going to find out. But the thing is, again, it's just like, you know, how do people find out about our organization? It's usually through lawsuits, right? And that we get media attention because of that. But not always. And word of mouth is the best kind of advertising possible. So anybody that you know, take them, you know, tell them to come to our website, tell them to sign up for either text messages or email messages, because when the stuff does hit the fan, and I'm going to talk about that in a minute, then it's an easy way for us to let everybody know as soon as possible.
Great. Thank you.
You're certainly welcome. Okay. So folks, this is another expression. I'm sorry. My family is colorful language. Drop the turd in the punch bowl. So here goes. When I was at the Sex Offender Management Board meeting 2 days ago, the alarm was sounded. This is the Sex Offender Management Board, folks. It's full of people from CDCR and DAPO and, you know, all those government initials. But there is a piece of legislation that is pending here in California. It's Senate Bill 1128, Senate Bill 1128. If this bill is passed, they're going to add up to 32,000 new people to the registry. 32,000 new people to the registry. The statistic at the meeting was there's currently 104,000 people on the registry. That would mean there's almost 136,000 people on the registry. That is alarm bell territory. Okay. So we are sounding the alarm and telling people we need to stop this bill. Unfortunately, we didn't know the impact of the bill until Thursday, right? I mean, it's kind of like, okay, there's more than 50 pieces of legislation that affect people required to register pending in our state legislature, right? This is one of the 50, 1, 2, 3, I forget, one of those bills. And this bill has the greatest impact because it would add, again, up to 32,000 people to the registry. This is not our organization's opinion. This is the fact given by the California Department of Justice during that meeting. California DOJ says it will add up to 32,000 people to the registry. That is because every person convicted of penal code section 261.5 to 61.5 will be required to register, and it will be applied retroactively. So 261.5, you may not know it by penal code section, but you'll probably know it by definition, statutory rape. So when a person underage has sex with another human being, then that's considered statutory rape because they lack the capacity to have sex. How freaking crazy is that in this day and time? And especially the state of California, like the federal government says, no sexual activity until you're 18 or older. Okay, well, that's just our society. So there is a hearing. This bill has already passed the Senate, which is the place where it was originated, and now it's going over to the state assembly. So there is a hearing. It's on July 2nd, July 2, just 2 days before the 4th of July, July 2nd, however you can remember it, here in Sacramento. We are asking you to show up in Sacramento and come to this hearing if at all possible. We need to stop this bill. Trust me, all you'll get to say is your name, rank, and serial number, but we need as many people as possible to show up at this hearing to let them know the legislature, they're about to make a very big mistake. So this is the last opportunity that we will have as a group to weigh in on this. July 2nd, 9 o'clock in the morning, it's in the state capitol. And go to our website. I think the room is 126, but I can't swear to that. So I can swear to July 2nd, 9 a.m. More than one bill will be considered that day. It could be a long day, depending upon when they actually get to 1128. But we have to let them know that they're making a very big mistake. So, JB, you have your hand up. Would you like to unmute yourself?
Just a comment and then question for you real quickly. One is, I was present at Lobby Day, and I will tell you, I have to promote this because presence makes a difference. If you're present, you're helping other people, even if it doesn't impact you. And if you can't be present, write a letter, because this is something that help that's going to impact a lot of people. So please remember to assist Axel as much as possible. The question I have is something that also was posted on your website, and there's some confusion here. Maybe you and Ellie, you or Ellie could answer this. What is the difference between a 288 and a 261? Because 288 has to register. Thank you.
Well, the 288, criminal defense attorney Ellie, why don't you answer that? Maybe a more precise answer.
Well, the 261 is what used to be called statutory rape, and that's a horrible term. It is primarily consensual intercourse when the victim is a minor and the person being charged with a crime is an adult. And when I was a public defender, I represented people who were charged with that, and it was usually girlfriend-boyfriend scenario where the girlfriend, after the consensual intercourse, went to the hospital and delivered a baby unbeknownst to her parents, who were clueless about the pregnancy. Parents get pissed off and they would then call the police and have the boyfriend arrested. So that's how it usually came about. It's also a wobbler, meaning that it could be charged as a misdemeanor or a felony. And I believe that I'd have to look at the 288 law. You kind of caught me off guard, but that's usually lewd and lascivious conduct with a minor, sometimes, mostly often under the age of 18, sometimes under the age of 14. Give me a minute. I hope I explained the 261.5 adequately. Give me a minute and I can look up the 288. Better yet, hold on.
And I'm back. Thank you for that brief break there, Ellie.
I'm getting on my penal code, JB.
All right, great.
288, I think, covers a wider range of behavior.
Ellie, when I looked at 261.5, I think it was said it's unlawful intercourse.
Correct. It's always been the same, but, you know,
But I think the 288 is broader behavior, because couldn't that include oral copulation and penetration as well? So because this is being recorded, Ellie, I'm going to keep talking. Put your hand up and look at me, and then we'll know that you have the answer. Okay, so somebody just asked in the chat room, it was a private question, what about July 2nd? So obviously he didn't catch it the first time, and I hope that you did. But here goes. Just in case you didn't, July 2nd is going to be a hearing. It's the Public Safety Committee of the Assembly. July 2nd, it starts at 9 o'clock in the morning, and it's in the state capitol. So if you can make it to Sacramento on July 2nd, please come join Axol, because we're going to go and we're going to testify in opposition to the bill. There'll be other things you can do if you can't come to Sacramento, or even if you can, letters to write, emails to be sent, phone calls to be made. Okay. Please understand, we only found out about this on Thursday afternoon. So I have written a letter of opposition. It's a formal letter of opposition that will be sent to the legislature, specifically to the Public Safety Committee that's conducting this hearing, asking the members of that committee to vote no on the bill. That a draft letter has been sent to the board members, the Axol board members, and I'm getting their input. So Monday, the formal letter will go in. And once there's a final letter, I will, in fact, put it on the website, okay, so that you'll have it there too. And then I will, at that point in time, invite other people to write letters as well. And I'll tell you where to send them. And the great thing is, these days, you can send them electronically, okay? You don't even have to put a stamp on it. You can send the letters electronically to the committee. So I don't see Ellie's head up.
Email?
Yes.
Yeah. Okay.
No, it's not through email. I'm sorry. There's a portal we can do through the committee, but I will put that on the website, so you will.
Okay. Yes. Thank you so much, Janice.
You're welcome, Peter. Thank you, Ellie.
So Janice, I think the question in regard to the 288. The 288A talks about lewd and lascivious conduct, so I think it encompasses more behavior, and also to arouse the lust of either the minor or the perpetrator, and then it gets into force and violence. 261.5 has no force or violence component. It is basically a consensual act, you know, and the minor is under 18. And like I said, more often than not, it's a girlfriend boyfriend thing. But 288 is broader and also encompasses the force or violence in subsection B. So I'm thinking that's what the difference is.
And I know some people who are convicted of 288 because they touched somebody on the outside of the clothing. So think about it. Intercourse versus touching somebody outside their clothing. So anyway, so this is the alarm bells. Please, 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 one more time, please help us stop Senate Bill 1128. So yes, I mentioned that over 30,000 people will be impacted, according to the California Department of Justice and their statement during the CASON meeting 2 days ago, up to 32,000 people, because they will have to go back retroactively and find all these people who've been convicted of 261.5. It's crazy. Can you imagine? You've been on you were convicted of this. You pled guilty to this more than 30 years ago. And for the first time in your life, you're going to have to register. This is absurd. So we'll see what happens.
The 261.5 as a misdemeanor can be expunged under the expungement law. The felony can't. And so I have a client with a 261.5 felony conviction, and I'm in the process of trying to get it reduced to a misdemeanor so that it can be expunged. And I don't know how many individuals have already had their misdemeanors expunged, but they're in for a rude awakening if this law passes.
Yeah, I will say one thing. The bill has been modified once already, and in that modification, they basically said, the modification was that there has to be an age gap of 10 years or more. So like if the victim was 16 and the alleged perpetrator was 27, then that would be 10 years or more. Okay, so it's not going to apply to every single person ever convicted of 261.5, but it will certainly affect a lot of people. And again, California DOJ statistic is 32,000 people. And it just... you think about it too in the context of the tiered registry law. So we've worked so hard to get a tiered registry law so that the number of people required to register could basically decrease, get smaller. And here, all of a sudden, they're going to add 32,000 new people to the registry. It just blows up the purpose of the tiered registry law. So, and Ellie says, I hope it will be challenged. Let's hope that before a challenge can happen, the governor will veto it. Yes. So all of those things. And I mean, the governor's office is the last resort. By the way, there's some other organizations that have already weighed in opposition to this bill. One of them is California Attorneys for Criminal Justice, CACJ. They're pretty well known here in Sacramento and in the state capital. They don't always get what they want, but sometimes they do. They do have, by the way, a paid lobbyist. We do not. Lou Romano.
What is the purpose of them wanting to pass this particular Senate bill? What's the need?
Well, okay, I'm going to sound a little cynical here, and I am. So some elected officials believe that the chances of them getting reelected will increase if they pass a bill that basically harms people in the registry.
Oh, it shows that they're being tough on crime.
There you go.
Thank you.
And Timothy Moore just said, what is going to cost the state? Aren't we in a deficit? Yes to both. There is going to be a significant cost. And that the gentleman from California DOJ who spoke at the meeting Thursday, that's what he said. So, you know, he said, you know, they had to figure out how many people could be added and then what would be the impact just on his agency, the Department of Justice. And of course, we know how terrible it would be for so many more people to be added to the registry. It just is mind-boggling. So anyway, please, please, please help us stop Senate Bill 1128. You can do it by writing letters. You can do it by making phone calls. You can do it by showing up in Sacramento. You can do it by donating money to AXL. So please, please, please consider doing one or all of those things. Okay, so let's go on to more happy news. But, you know, even before I do that, I know we have people who are listening today who are from states other than California. And again, we welcome you all. We're so pleased to have you join us. There is something. So it does dovetail with Senate Bill 1128, because you might be asking yourself, how could they apply that retroactively? Well, in part, it's because of a U.S. Supreme Court decision that was issued in the year 2000. 2003. It's called Smith versus Doe. What a boring name, right? But on the other hand, it's had such a significant and adverse impact upon the registrant community that you need to memorize Smith versus Doe, at least the name of it, okay? So in Smith versus Doe, the U.S. Supreme Court said that the reoffense rate for people on the registry was, quote, frightening and high, up to 80%, which is total nonsense, okay? That information, by the way, or that misinformation truly came from a magazine article. What? Since when does the U.S. Supreme Court rely upon magazine articles, right? It wasn't research done or anything else. It was just one person saying, well, you know, if people who are required to register take my classes, then you know, they will be less likely to reoffend. And oh, by the way, the reoffense rate is, quote, frightening and high. So that those words, frightening and high, are just terrible. So in the U.S. Supreme Court's decision 21 years ago, they basically said that they said registry is not punishment. Think about that. They're telling you that your requirement to register is not punishment. It makes no sense to me. They said, oh, it's a mere administrative requirement. Okay. So I cry bullshit. But so at some point in time, you have to put a bell around the cat's neck. You all heard about that, the mice, you know, they're like, oh, this cat keeps eating me and our family members, stuff like that. We need to know when they're coming. So a bunch of mice got together and they put a bell on a cat so they knew when the cat was coming. Well, we need to do that with the U.S. Supreme Court. We need, or maybe we're training a puppy, I'm not sure. And so one method some people use in training a puppy is if they should have a, quote, accident on the floor, you rub your nose and their nose on it. Well, we need to rub the noses of the Supreme Court justices on this issue. They made a mistake. They made a really big mistake. And you know what? They need to correct it. And folks, I do not know what the current members of the U.S. Supreme Court think about this. And quite frankly, I don't care. The fact is, they're doing all kinds of things that are unexpected. So this may be one of the things they might be willing to overturn Smith versus Doe. We'll never know until we invite them to overturn Smith versus Doe. And I am so devoted to this, overturning this decision, I personally have become a member of their bar association, which means that I could argue a case in front of the Supreme Court. Wouldn't that be cool? I've done it before the California Supreme Court, and I was successful there. So the U.S. Supreme Court, you know, let me at them. I'd be happy to argue a case in front of them. So we'll see. It may be me. It may be another attorney. It might be our Pacific Legal Foundation attorney, Molly Nixon, who does. But the fact is, we need to overturn Smith versus Doe. And that is why for 2 years in a row, we have gone to Washington, D.C. In March and had a vigil. We called it a vigil. It really was a protest, okay? And so we're going to do it again in next year. On March 5th of 2025, we will be in Washington, D.C. Please come join us. I'm giving you a lot of advance warning so you can, you know, put together your financial resources and get yourself to Washington, D.C. We will be as close to the steps of the U.S. Supreme Court as possible on March 5th of 2025. We did it this year. We did it last year. And we tell them Smith versus Doe must go. That's my favorite saying, chant. Smith versus Doe must go. And to make things just a little more bizarre, but sometimes life is bizarre, right? That the attorney who represented the state of Alaska, because that was what it was about. It was about the Alaska Sex Offender Registry. That's what was at issue. The attorney representing the state of Alaska, his name is John Roberts. John Roberts, does that sound familiar? Yes, it's the same John Roberts who's currently the Chief Justice of the U.S. Supreme Court. And so I particularly want to get that puppy's nose and rub it in this mess that he's made and said, look, John Roberts, you have an opportunity as the Chief Justice of the U.S. Supreme Court to clean up the mess that you made. Do it now. Okay, so we'll see how many years it's going to take. But you know what? They're never going to change unless we remind them that they need to change. And, you know, the Supreme Court, the U.S. Supreme Court does overturn its decisions. It makes stupid decisions, maybe even recently, maybe even yesterday. Oh, well. But the fact is that the U.S. Supreme Court has made decisions that are stupid, not based upon the law, and have been overturned. One of them, you might not remember the case called, it's called, versus Ferguson. Anyway, I'll think of their full name But there was a case that decided, the U.S. Supreme Court decided that separate but equal education was just fine. Okay? We don't care about black and brown kids. We don't care about kids in Mississippi, no matter what color they are. Separate but equal education is just fine with us. And it took over 50 years for that decision to be overturned. And it was overturned in the decision that a lot of us know by name, Brown versus Board of Education. Okay? I think that Plessy versus Ferguson, that was the case where they made the wrong decision. And it took over 50 years for them to correct it. I'm not that patient, folks. I'm not a patient person. I don't plan to become a patient person. I don't think a civil rights attorney should be patient. Okay. So the fact is we need to overturn Smith versus Doe as well. And one way to do that is to actually get the court to accept a case, anybody's case, that could actually lead to that result. So we'll see what happens. By the way, another big mistake that the U.S. Supreme Court made, the case was called Korematsu with a K. In the Korematsu case, our U.S. Supreme Court said, it's okay to put people of Japanese descent in internment camps. What? That was so effing stupid. It still makes me angry, you can tell. And when I was in law school, my roommate was of Japanese descent, and both of her parents were put in internment camps. So I got to hear some of her stories, and it makes no sense. And so fortunately, the U.S. Supreme Court said, oops, and they cleaned up that mess as well. So it has happened before. It doesn't happen very often, but we need to, like training that puppy, I said, rub their nose in it and get them to fix them, clean up the mess that they've made. So March 5th, one time again, March 5th of 2025, Axel will be by as close as possible to the U.S. Supreme Court, and we will, in fact, have a protest. And we ask you to join us. Folks, we're not loud, but we are proud. But anyway, we don't make a mess of things. We clean up after ourselves. We have a little PA system. We know what the rules of the court are, and so we don't get ourselves arrested. But the fact is, please come join us. It'll be a life-changing experience, I promise you. And we did it we had people from multiple states who came and joined us, and it was a very positive experience. Okay, let's talk about some more. I talked about the CDCR treatment case and how we won that. We won another case recently, and that has to do with attempted offenses. So people convicted of attempted offenses in California were being assigned to the same tier as people convicted of completed offenses. And yes, I'm talking about even rape. So if you were convicted, that's what California DOJ did. That was their interpretation of the tiered registry law. And we said, you got it wrong, DOJ. So we sued them. We don't sue DOJ nearly as often as we sued the California Department of Corrections, because guess what? DOJ has a whole agency full of lawyers. So we really are very picky about what lawsuits we file challenging them. But we felt very strongly that this is a misinterpretation of the tiered registry law. And again, that somebody who was convicted of an attempted offense should not be put on the same tier as somebody convicted of a completed offense, including rape. So I call it the zipper situation. Okay. So let's just say somebody says, hey, I'm going to do blinkety blink to you and unzips a zipper. That's probably attempted rape, or could be attempted rape. Let me put it that way, that you get convicted of. But the fact is, the person says thanks but no thanks in so many words, and so the other person leaves the room, okay, and doesn't carry through with the words that they said they're going to do and with the unzip zipper. So that we filed this lawsuit in Los Angeles Superior Court, and we won. And so now California DOJ is in fact assigning people convicted of an attempted offense to a different tier than the completed offense. So for rape, it's probably not going to be down to tier one, but it's probably going to be to tier two. But tier two is 20 years, and tier three is for life. So it's a significant difference. And JD, you have your hand up?
Yes.
Yes. Hi. I have a question. Why does the Department of Justice represent parole agents that are sued versus the CDCR lawyers themselves?
Would you repeat that question? I'm not sure I understood it.
Why does the Department of Justice represent the CDCR parole agent when they're being sued versus the CDCR's own attorneys?
I can explain it. It may take a minute, so please bear with me, everybody. Okay, so if an agency gets sued, believe it or not, the agency attorneys do not usually represent them in court. And instead, you have the Attorney General's office. It's not DOJ. DOJ is a part of the Attorney General's office, but not all of it. So that's why. So the Attorney General is really the lawyer for all of the agencies. But I will say, in this the recent CDCR case, it was an agency attorney who basically made a difference.
I see. I was just kind of confused about that.
Yeah. Well, you know what? Believe it or not, folks, try not to hold this against me. I used to be a federal government attorney myself. Okay. And so I worked for NASA. I worked for the Air Force. And I eventually worked for Congress. I say I have really mixed past, checkered past, in fact. So the fact is, though, that when I worked for, let's say, NASA, I could not represent the agency in litigation. I could help the litigator, but I couldn't be the person who was actually litigating, unless special circumstances and all kinds of approvals happened. I ended up doing once as an Air Force attorney and won the case. But anyway, I digress. So the attempts case, by the way, some people have asked me, is that the same as assault with the intent to commit a sex offense? The answer is no. So in your conviction, it has to be 6-6, is it 4 or 7, Ellie, this attempt? I think it's a 4.
4, 6-6-4.
Okay, so if you have a 6-6-4 slash sex offense, then this applies to you, but you're going to have to come to somebody like me or another attorney to get a new tier assignment. And, you know, this is part of what pisses me off, quite frankly. So California DOJ lost, they agreed to do this thing, but then they don't set up a mechanism so that the individual who's on the registry, I like your umbrella, Michael, that the people on the registry, you know, have the burden then to go into California DOJ and request a new tier assignment. It's like crazy, but that's what you have to do. So I have written several letters now, and I have been successful at getting people's tiers reassigned. So if you're in that situation, if in fact you've been convicted of an attempted sex offense, then I can help you get a new tier assignment. So please contact me by email, contact me by phone. It seems like everybody has my phone number, but maybe not yet. I think my phone number is written on prison walls. I'm pretty sure of that because I get lots of calls. So anyway, I'm not complaining. And I get fan mail too from people in prison. So anyway, I digress. So attempts, you know, there's help on the way. I've talked about Senate Bill 1128 and how we need everybody's help to stop that. I've talked about the Axol conference, but I think it helps to repeat the dates, September 20 and September 21. Those are, pardon me, the dates of our annual conference. It will be a virtual conference. That means you don't have to travel to go there. And we hope that every single person here today and who are listening later will, in fact, join our conference. We keep our conference fees very, very low for a reason. I'm sure it'll be low this year as well. And so that as many people as possible participate. And we'll ask you to sign up, not register. We'll ask you to sign up for the conference starting in about 30 days. Okay. I think that's about everything that I was planning to talk about today. Let's give people an opportunity here, in fact, to, if you have a question or a comment before we end the meeting. Anybody out there? I'm not seeing any hands go up. I guess you want to go eat lunch just the same as I do. Ellie, how about you? Do you have any parting words?
No, I don't, but there is a question in the chat about an in-person meeting for San Diego area.
The next in-person meeting is actually in Sacramento. It's on July 13th. So thank you for the person. We don't have a date yet for San Diego, but we will be there in the fall for sure. Peter, you have your hand up? Peter?
Yeah. So Senate Bill 1128, would that apply to me that mine is just a felony with 290 with a victim younger than 14?
Well, I guess the question, Peter, is, are you currently required to register?
Yes.
Well, it's not going to make you register a second time. So it won't affect you in that way. Okay.
Thank you.
Mark, can you unmute yourself, Mark?
There we go. Okay. Excellent. Anyway, I had to step away for just a second or two, but I think I heard you briefly mention the case in Missouri. Is that going to be something that we can log in and listen to and watch online or not? Because I wanted to be there and I can't.
Okay. Actually, I just mentioned it in passing, but it's a good thing for me to mention. I mentioned in passing that we are now filing lawsuits outside the state of California. The first lawsuit we filed outside our state is, in fact, in Missouri, and we are challenging a requirement that registrants in Missouri post a sign on the front door of their home on Halloween. And so that is in trial. That's why I'm not going to be in my office most of next week. The trial is next Thursday and Friday, June 20th and June 21st. And so I don't have a precise answer to your question, Mark. If you were to send me an email, I will find out the answer for you and let you know. I know there are some people in the registrant community in Missouri who are going to be there, and that's fine. It's a public hearing. My only hesitation is I just hope, you know, we don't have the registrants and the anti-registrants there at the same time, but it's a public hearing and then a public courtroom. So whoever shows up is going to show up.
Okay.
And you know what? So the plaintiff in this case, by the way, is somebody who is required to register in Missouri. He was convicted of one sex offense a long time ago, over 20 years ago. And for the longest time, he was told by government officials, by the way, that their Halloween law did not apply to him. So he used to have a big Halloween party in the front yard of his house, of his property, for over 15 years. And it was only recently that somebody decided that it did apply to him. They didn't tell him that. And in fact, they just arrested him. And part of the reason they arrested him is he did not have a sign on the front door of his home. So, folks, this is a violation of the U.S. Constitution, specifically the First Amendment to the Constitution. And like most people think of the First Amendment as the right to speak, but there's also a right to be silent. So this speech is government speech, and they are compelling people to speak this government speech by having a sign on the front door of their house. By the way, we have a very similar case in Arkansas, which is just the state south of Missouri, and there is sign requirements even worse, because you have to put the sign on your front door for 2 weeks, not 1 day, but 2 weeks. So we have sued them as well. And by the way, and finally, there's something going on in southern Texas down in the Rio Grande Valley. And if you know anybody who lives down in the Rio Grande Valley who's on the registry, please ask them to contact me, because we need a plaintiff in the case before we can sue them. Okay, JJ, your hand is up.
Hi again.
Hi.
Okay, so I was wondering how you would suggest going about reducing my husband's a tier 3 lifetime registrant, how you would go about trying to get his tier assignment reduced after it's already been coming up on 20 years. Where would we start?
Well, the number of years you register does not affect your tier assignment. It's all based upon the conviction offense. And again, if you'll contact me privately, we can talk about what he was convicted of.
Okay.
I think I have a pretty good guess based on what you said earlier, but I don't know for sure. And the thing is, as part of our lobbying efforts, and this is something beyond, you know, this calendar year, is we're preparing to lobby the state legislature one more time here about improving the tiered registry law. And one of the major improvements would be to create a tier, an off-ramp, so that people who are assigned to tier 3 would no longer be required to register for life, but in fact would have an opportunity to petition for removal. So.
Okay. Thank you so much for everything you do. I think you're so awesome. I keep telling my husband, she's so amazing. He's listening. Thank you for all your hard work and all that you do. You're amazing.
Well, thank you.
You have a good heart. We appreciate you.
Thank you. And I will say that something I consider to be a compliment. So if you ever want to compliment me, you can tell me I'm a badass lawyer.
Oh, you are. No, you're a badass lawyer. That's what I kept saying. I'm like, she is gangster. She does not play around. I love it.
But the approach I take, I try not to come in, you know, like I'm totally on fire and in flames. I mean, why do I look the way that I do? I try to look like I'm mainstream. I don't think mainstream, but I look mainstream. Because I tell you what, if I went into a courtroom and I had purple hair and it was all spiky, I don't think I'd get the good result out of the judge.
Yeah, the way you would want it, that you would look. Yeah. Yeah, your personality.
So, you know, we all do what we have to do. And so I believe in marketing. And that's my way of marketing myself as mainstream.
Oh, definitely. Okay. You're the cutest. You're badass. Thank you, Janet. Okay, bye.
All right. Thank you, everybody, for sticking in this meeting for over 2 hours. Again, I hope that you've written some dates down, that you'll be in Sacramento on July 2nd. That you'll join our conference on September 20th and 21, and then you'll join us in Washington, D.C. on March 5th of next year. Thank you all. Thank you. So blessed to be here to help you. Bye-bye.